Succession number 27460, Reel 11.
So you didn't make the RAF? Mr. Wilkes, Reel 11. So you didn't make the RAF?
No. So I went back down again and saw the CO, and he was most apologetic and said, if your CO will not release you, there's nothing more I can do for you. But he said, I would very much like to have you with me. So that was the end of that. So by now, my blood was beginning to boil a bit. And so I submitted an application to join the paratroopers, for which they were wanting volunteers, and once again the same result, out it went into the waste paper basket. I applied for the commandos and the same thing happened, so I could see I was getting nowhere. But at the same time, the colonel seemed to be making quite a lot of me all the time, and he entrusted me with taking his sons to the station to go back to private school and this sort of thing. Couldn't understand. Thought, well, he must have some trust, but I couldn't see I could get on very far in headquarters. But anyway, that was where I stayed, and then, just to spoil things for me, they must have decided that the complement of mechanics in headquarters could comprise a full bombardier and a lance bombardier. And so a bombardier was put in charge of me. I had to hand all my tools over and everything. And this didn't go down very well. Along with the fact that he was a very rough mechanic. Everything he did was rough and ready. He'd been a farm worker at one time. And I think he was used to working on with farm machinery and that. But anyway, he stayed with us until the time came to go abroad.
And were there problems between you because of this?
Slightly. The friction was because I would spend time doing a job and he wanted it done more quickly and just rough and ready. Cover up with a bit of paint and that'll be it.
Do you recall his name?
Stokes. Bombardier Stokes.
And as you say, it must have been a great disappointment because you've been carrying all this work for quite a long time.
Yes, I had. And I'd gained a lot of respect from the drivers. They knew the way I wanted to do jobs. And this did used to upset the bombardier, of course. If anyone came to me, you could come to me, he used to say. You don't go to him, you come to me.
Were there any other mechanics attached to you? You've got a bombardier, lance bombardier?
No more in headquarters, no.
Just the two of you?
Just the two. I'd been in charge of myself up till then.
You were there when America came into the war. Do you recall that happening?
Yes. That was, well, two dates come to mind. The 7th is what, 7th of December is what the Japanese say, and the 8th of December is what is in my mind. The 8th of December, it was easy to remember because it was my grandmother's birthday.
What was the feeling when this happened?
It was a bit of shock, really. We were feeling very upset and worried because the Japanese were having such conquests that we, before I'd even gone into the army, we'd seen some of the horrific things they were doing in China. So we were just wondering, or I was wondering, what things would turn out like now that they'd entered the war.
And you'd been, in effect, getting American equipment prior to this that was coming presumably on lease land and this kind of thing.
Well, whatever it is, yes.
So you're getting, you know, you had some experience of that. Did you feel, or did they, all of you feel that, oh, you know, we've got this very powerful nation on our side now, we're gonna win the war?
Well, I don't know if we did, really. I think we were badly shaken because during that 1941, we'd suffered the loss of the Hood, The Germans fortunately had gone into Russia and not come here, and we just and of course they were winning all their battles. We thought there's no way we'll beat, but we've got to try. We've got to try and be efficient. And so I think it was general with everyone that they wanted to do the job to the best of their ability.
And still the spirit and morale was there for...
Oh, yes.
...for the day when you would win it.
That's right. So then, of course, as we know, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and things... We began to hear of all the conquests they were making. And then it's at this point that I learned that the second line regiment of the TA regiment that I'd joined, they had been stationed, funny enough, at Woolsingham for a short while, and they had gone to the Far East, and they were all taken prisoner, and along with their guns, without firing a shot. And so...
This would be Singapore, was it?
That's right. Yeah. So we felt as though we were fighting a losing battle, but what do you do? You can't just throw in the towel.
And there's bad news in the desert, of course, at that point
yes,
in time.
Yes, that's right. Now, the guns that we had been issued with, we never dreamt that they would send us far east. Never dreamt of one. We thought it's a desert gun, that would all right. Has the range, but 16,000 yards, you know, you could reach the enemy long distance.
Well, have you any other memories of being at Witton away for the final part of the period of year that you were there?
Yes. Well, in the October of 41, we got engaged. My wife and I, we got engaged at that point. And then we kept hearing rumours and we thought, well, shall we get married or shall... You know, it was touch and go. And then eventually we did go all out and get married in the February... of 42.
Did you have to get permission of your commanding officer?
Oh, yes. And thereby lies another story, because my mother had already started sowing seeds of discontent. She didn't want me to get married and all that sort of thing, and the padre was very nice to us and talked to both Emily and me. It worked out all right in the end. We did get married.
And your mother's, did you get the opportunity to meet your wife to be before you were married?
Oh, no. She never wanted to be. She wrote her some horrible letters.
So that side was not very pleasant.
It wasn't, no.
And your wife's side, were they happy?
Oh, they were happy, yes, very.
So they would have got the chance and the opportunity to know you, of course.
That's right. I think they'd come to the conclusion I was respectable.
What difference did it make to your army pay now that you're married?
Do you know, I can't remember what the marriage allowance was. I just can't remember.
But you would get a marriage allowance.
Oh, yes, I got a marriage allowance, commensurate with my rank.
Well,
of course, I had to contribute so much of my money to that as well.
And where were you married?
In Crook, at the Presbyterian Church. There were Presbyterians and... No problem there.
And did you have a prior to the wedding party with your mates and things like that?
No, I didn't, because not being a drinker, I didn't get involved in anything like that. And I think I just got a lot of good wishes, and that was it. And I was married on a 48-hour leave. It was very short.
What happened to you next?
Big pardon?
What happened next to you?
As regards the marriage, or...?
Well, as regards the army, so.
Oh, well, shortly after we got married, it was confirmed. There was one day I'd just finished, because I was working up in the towers here, but I had permission to live out. You see, I was sleeping out at the farm, and I was making my way, and I'd said to him, I said, I'll be home on the 12:10 bus, and then we'll go down to Bishop Auckland. So I'd put in a pass and everything for that. So as it was approaching 12 o'clock, and I was on my way down, I was stopped by one of the soldiers. He said, "Muster parade in the dining room, 12 o'clock. And so I went up to the dining room, and there it was, and the adjutant told us that we were now going to go abroad. He said, "I can't tell you where, but," he said, "I would think in about 6 weeks' time we'll be sailing down the west coast of Africa." So this was it. After the muster parade, we had to go down to the quartermaster stores and give our hat sizes and we'd for everything for tropical kit. And they said that 50% of the troops would be going on embarkation leave immediately, 2 weeks. So, and the other half would go after about 3 days after the others came back. And so, when I looked at the list, and I didn't see either my name or Bombardier Stokes' name on for the leave. So I mentioned to Stokes, he says, "Why worry?" He says, "I'm not." I said, "But I'm concerned." I said, "I'll go and see them." So I went down to the office and I said, "There's two names not on either of those embarkation lists, Bombardier Stokes or myself." And of course, the clerk was a bit upset because I think he felt guilty. So anyway, the next I knew, Bombardier Stokes was sent on leave. Of course, he was about 3 or 4 days behind the rest now. So I had visions that I might not get on leave. And there was such a lot to do, the vehicles that were going to go, and I was making sure that everything was right. But I was pleased I was in that happy position. So Sergeant Stokes came back, but I think it was only back maybe 24 hours, possibly not that, when I was sent on leave. And when I came back off leave, all the vehicles and the guns and Sergeant Stokes had gone. And so many were accompanying the vehicles and guns over.
Now, did you spend your leave at the farm with your wife?
Oh, no. I'd looked my father up in the meantime, and I spent a bit of time there. Spent most of the time up at the farm, but spent a bit of time down there.
So the preparations for going abroad, as you say, you check your vehicles and everything. You were being measured for, or at least you'd been going to be issued. Been issued with your tropical kit at this point in time?
Yes, the tropical kit had come through, and we'd all been issued with it.
Had you the opportunity to try it on to make sure it fitted you?
Oh, yes, tried it on. Of course, we all looked stupid at it, didn't we?
What did the people of Whitney Weed, did they realise you were going abroad?
Yes.
This well-kept secret
It was anything but a well-kept secret, yes. Now then, it's rather peculiar, but the Whit Monday, 1942, was the day those that were left were having the day off, virtually. But being a bit of a person that's dedicated, I'd come over from the farm to report in, just to make sure that they knew I was still around. And I went up to the guard room and I had a look, because we still had some vehicles, impressed vehicles, and a few army vehicles that weren't going abroad with us. And I had a look to see if there was anything needed doing. And when I got up there, the guard commander said, "You've got to go over to Witten Castle. There's been a bit of a problem there with the lights." So I went over, and the colonel had either broken a standing lamp or something, so it needed some new wiring, so I had to go to Crook. And fortunately there was a shop that was open that I was able to get some cable from. And when I'd fixed that light, then there was more to it than that. There were one or two others that had landed in trouble. So I'd gone to sort them out and then gone to Crook again to get some more cable. As I came back into Witton Mi Weir in the afternoon, I was in my wife's car as she was running me back because I hadn't had an army vehicle to go up in to Crook. And so she was running me back to Howden. And so I was flagged down by someone out of the army. He said, "Do you know there's a muster parade at 4 o'clock? I said, "No." He said, 4 o'clock. Well, it was just about 4 o'clock then. So they were forming up on beside the church, which was our parade ground. So we were told then that this was it. We had to parade with all our kit at 10 o'clock that night down at Station House, down Clemmy Bank. So, okay, so I managed to get an army vehicle then to nip across to do the job at the castle, finished the lights off, and I came back and then I went over and had a meal and got all freshened up, got my stuff all ready. And then my wife and her brother and her cousin, who was staying that weekend, brought me over to Witton, and we went down to Station House. And when we got down there, there were quite a few fellows that were inebriated by then, because the people in the village here had made sure of it. And the regiment was well liked because we'd been well disciplined. So
when you left a station, did you have to ensure that it was left almost in the same condition as you'd gone into it? You know,
yes.
About lights and damages and this kind of thing.
That's right. And there was a rear party left behind. Now, these were people that weren't going to go abroad with us, people that were being replaced. One of them was an old soldier. He'd done two stints abroad and that, so that was him. So, pale.
Was anyone coming into your place, replacing you in the village?
Not that we knew of.
It must have been quite a thing. I mean, it's obviously been a very sad moment for your wife and the family that you were leaving abroad into the unknown.
Perfectly true, yes. And but the thing was, at 10 o'clock, that wasn't the end of it. We were sent home then. There was going to be a meal at 2:15 in the morning in the dining hall, a cooked meal. So we went home, we had our meal at home, and then, you just can't settle to do anything when it's like that. But eventually it got round to about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was brought back to Witton here. And then we had to march down to the station. Well, I think just about everyone out the village was there to see us off. I think the only people that wouldn't be there would be very tiny babies and the infirm. We had to push your way through with your kit on to get onto the train. And eventually we got on. And the train made slow progress down to Bishop Auckland. And then I think it was joined up with trains that had started at Etherley and Toft Hill and Crook. And then we set off. And the train just trundled along all day, very slow speed, and we got... It
would be a pretty uncomfortable journey, presumably, with your kit in your carriage, isn't it?
Well, there wasn't a lot of room, but it was there. And
how did you feel personally about going abroad?
Optimistic. I shouldn't say it didn't enter my mind that I might not come back, because it did. But I wanted to make sure that if I went out and I did my duty, no one could criticise me for anything that I hadn't done.
And there must have been an emotional element in that, leaving your wife.
Oh, very, very. We were both torn apart, but we knew it had to be. Someone had to do it. So that was it.
Well, where did the train take you?
Well, it trundled away up towards Edinburgh, and then it cut across towards Glasgow, and then eventually it landed down to Greenock. And the train eventually came to a stop, not beside a platform or anything, but through the fence we could see this great big ship. And we were told to dismount, and it's a long way jumping out of a carriage with your kit down to the bottom. But we jumped down, and eventually when we were formed up, we marched through the gate and away and up onto the ship, which was the SS Otranto.
Right, before we go any further, you'd said your vehicles had gone before you. They were going with you to the Far East.
Oh, yes. But they'd sailed from Hartlepool. And whether they went round the North Cape or what, I don't know, they'd gone right round that top end.
Did they meet up with you in that convoy that you know of? Or?
I don't know. I think they probably would.
So this is, you've got this huge ship, probably the biggest ship you'd seen in your life, haven't you?
Yes. It was a 22,000 tonne Orient Line ship. And we boarded that. Where headquarters was allocated was Deck G8, where we went down, and we reckoned up that the deck was level with the sea. We were so far down. A deck was the very top deck. We boarded the ship, and by now we were pretty hungry. And, we got down on the deck and we were wondering when we might get a meal or something. And we sort of sorted out where we were going to sleep. There was this great row of hammocks that we had to bag one and put our name on it. And there were hooks in the roof, in the girders, where we could tie our hammocks onto. And the underside of the girders had been boarded over, so that you'd place us to stow your kit on top of the, like, shelving. And God help you if you had a piece of string hanging down, the captain of the ship would have your guts for garters.
How did you find, putting these cumbersome beasts and hanging them up and then getting into them?
You learnt. Yes. So.
Were they comfortable to sleep in?
Not really, but you got used to them. I didn't sleep in mine all the time. I sometimes slept on the open deck when I possibly could.
Was this a mess deck that you were on?
Yes.
With tables underneath?
That's right. Our table held 22. And the hammocks were spread over the top, and some slept under the tables because the hammocks were... They fitted like sardines. You know, the shape of a hammock. It tapers at each end and the wide bit in the middle. And they were so positioned that you got the wide bit between two narrow ends. Anyway, our first meal on board that ship, we were told we were going to get a meal and to organise some stewards for each table. And they said, when you hear your deck number called out, they've got to make their way up. Well, they went up, and a most disgusting meal, we ate it. The main course had been some boiled mutton, but it had started to go cold and the fat was settling on the mess tins that had come down in. And you got a piece of this nearly cold mutton. You tried to avoid the gravy. The potatoes weren't peeled and they hadn't been washed, so we had all the grit with those. And I think they'd boiled the cauliflower in the same water, because that was all gritty. And that was followed by something I detest, tapioca pudding, so I didn't have that. But that was the meal. Anyway, the menu used to run on a four-day cycle. I remember every fourth day we got tripe for lunch, which was horrific. There was more wasted than ever eaten.
So the meals on board the ship were not particularly good?
Some of them were. The smoked fish at breakfast was nice. But once again, every fourth day, the odd day you got a piece of bacon or you got a sausage. You never got very much, but our colonel went and had a talk with the captain of the ship, who originally hadn't wanted to sail with as many men on board. He wanted 500 taken off, but he didn't get his way. Our colonel managed to organise that we would each get a mug of cocoa at night, I think about 8 o'clock. You had to be in bed at 9. So I think this cocoa was at 8 o'clock, and you got a slice of bread that was baked on the ship, which was beautiful. Bread and marge, or bread and butter, something like that. Life on the ship, well, it started 6 a.m. was reveille, roll call 15 minutes past, on A deck, where we paraded for gymnastics. Well, our ship, we didn't get the gymnastics for the first 2 or 3 days, but the ship, we boarded on the Tuesday, the 26th, and then on the 27th...
It's May, 27th.
Of May, yes, it sailed out into the Clyde and anchored there, and there we remained until Sunday, the 31st of May. And incidentally, as they were casting off from the side of the dock, some chaps from a Scottish regiment jumped from the ship, landed on coils of rope, but were... Some of them were caught immediately, some managed to get off the dock. I don't know. Some of the dockers blocked the way of the military police that were trying to catch them, but that was going on. Anyway, we lay out in the Clyde till Sunday afternoon, and we were suddenly told last mail going ashore. We'd been told that a couple of times before, but then a chap came down. He said, we'll be sailing tonight. Of course, some of these chaps that had had connections with ships knew a lot, and this fellow said, if you don't believe me, get up on deck and have a look and see what you think. Well, he said, you'll see all the smokestacks smoking away there, which was true. The ships were all getting up steam, ready to sail. And it was such a beautiful day, beautiful evening. But as the ship was swinging round on the anchors, if you were looking inland, everything looked beautiful and tranquil. You swung round the other way as the tide turned, and lots of black clouds hanging over the estuary. And, of course, about 8 o'clock at night, up came the anchors. We felt the main engine start to run, and we were underway.
Did you get a chance to be up on deck and see us?
Yes.
Sailing away from the country?
We did. And we were still on deck when we felt the first surges of the currents starting to lift it in the swell. Well, we went down below, we got our cocoa and that. I think they'd particularly been waiting for this day. I think the meteorologists had been reckoning up that if we waited till now, the ships could sail in comparative safety because the sea would be too rough for the U-boats to operate. And I know I woke up round about midnight. There was this awful crash, and I thought, oh my God, we've been torpedoed. But we hadn't. It was just one wave after another that was coming at us, and it was really shaking everything. The ship was creaking and groaning from stem to stern, but we were keeping going. The hammocks were swinging. Oh, it was... I managed a little more sleep after that.
Did you suffer from seasickness as a result of this?
Yes, I had 5 days of it.
And it isn't very pleasant.
It isn't, no. We got up on deck on the first day at sea, and of course every day we had 1 hour's boat stations. Of course, this was particularly harrowing because being on the open deck, the sea breaking over us, the waves were so huge, it was cold, and through the mist we saw this aircraft carrier that was escorting us, and we saw them bring 2 aircraft up on deck, and we saw them run the engines up, and then they took them back down again. It was too rough for them. And then the next day...
What was the... were you being seasick by now?
Yes, but I'd had an hour on deck. I think most of us were feeling bad. And I always remember a chap out of one of the batteries. He was an Irish lad, a boxer, and he came and he stuffed some chocolate down my throat. He said, at least you'll have something to bring up. which was rather comforting.
And I suppose it's difficult to take to meals for the days that you're ill.
I bore in mind, you see, my mother had known about, her husband had been seasick when they'd travelled over to this country, and I remembered her saying, you must always eat. So I did my best to try and always eat so that I had something on my stomach, because you could damage your stomach.